Bill Ober has been here in biomedical informatics at UW longer than I, which means at least 10 years. I don't know, more than that, but not. He made, I would say, a name for himself in biosurveillance, and did some great work there. And now is still connected in global health, and has an interesting title there at the end. Appropriate for global health thing, he's going to talk about resource poor settings.
Yeah. So, I hadn't really thought about introducing where I came from or anything, but I started at UW in 1997 when I finished my residency in emergency medicine, and then I did a National Library of Medicine fellowship with Jim Brinkley before this program was established. There used to be an independent fellowship you could apply for if your program, the F38, which you could apply for if your school didn't have a regular training program. So that's the only reason I'm older, is started here early. Anyhow, what I wanted to talk about was this notion of trying to translate some of the engineering work that we do into durable design patterns to help with connecting information systems at facilities in resource-poor settings. This kind of stuff, the first thing we published on this was back in MedInfo 2010, Deborah Revere and Becky Hills and I, Becky, who just finished, who presumably most everybody would know. Anyway, Deborah and Becky and I published something in MedInfo on kind of this approach to looking at specific components and trying to build an architecture from them. And so because the title's got a lot of words in it, I kind of want to tackle these backwards and start with just some general stuff on what do I mean by resource-poor settings, talk a little bit about facility-level architectures, very briefly about design patterns, and then kind of go into why I think that electronic medical record systems to lab systems in Haiti is kind of a good template for looking at that kind of work. So I work in three areas. John sort of alluded to that. I do work in public health informatics, mostly for CDC and Washington State Department of Health. I work in global health. I'm the director of informatics for a UW-UC San Francisco NGO called ITEC, and which primarily is funded by HIV care and treatment programs by PEPFAR in about 14 countries. We have informatics programs in six of those countries: Haiti, Cote d'Ivoire, Kenya, Namibia, and Vietnam. Mozambique is really just sort of a project that I have doing some consulting with UCSF. It's not a full-blown project. But in Haiti, Kenya, and Vietnam, we're involved with enough different systems that we're interested in architecture both at the national level and at the facility level. I thought I would just, I'm kind of torn because I don't like the travelogue kind of global health slides, but I sort of wanted to do that a little bit and just talk about resource-poor settings. So lab in Kenya. It doesn't look all that, this is the lab in Cote d'Ivoire, and it doesn't look all that resource poor, and it isn't. It's very much like the kind of stuff you'd find downstairs in a much more limited service area. By downstairs, I mean in WMC's clinical lab, but with much more limited services. Cote d'Ivoire, this is a clinical facility. Resource poor settings means some of the infrastructure, power. Power may not work so well. Physical security might not be so good. This is a picture from the CDC office in Nairobi looking out over the Kibera slums, which is kind of one of the largest concentrations of poverty in Africa. I think it's a million and something people live out in that valley in kind of ramshackle housing. And this CDC, ironically, is perched on the hill right above it. The kind of facilities that one sees in Africa, just a waiting area for an HIV clinic out in western Kenya, a laboratory which is considerably more primitive than the last lab we looked at, and information. And this is kind of going to get to what we really do, is work with information systems of all kinds at the facility level. So this is the register of the official government register of people who are HIV positive but who've not yet been started on ART. This happens to be a clinic in western Kenya. Clinical facilities, like often not a lot of infrastructure investment, but, big factory in the background there. Sometimes it really is resource poor. So we work in Haiti, and the earthquake had a huge impact on what we do. The national hospital shifted into to working in tents, literally, in many cases. Some of the buildings were standing but unsafe. And our focus is really just still on the information systems. In whatever setting the clinical care is being practiced, we try and provide information systems support. The current facility-level information architecture is almost always you're starting with paper and paper artifacts. We're a bit beyond that here now, but, you know, 10 years ago it was probably true that pretty much most clinical facilities still ran on physical artifacts that were being traded around, even if there was an information system where scanned versions of those would wind up. So the current facility-level information architecture may be paper, but it's a real architecture. There are artifacts being collected for distinct purposes. They flow through a specific route. They're aggregated. They're used on an individual level for patient care and so forth. And generally, the flow is one of paper into systems and into larger systems. Paper into systems for individual health, and then into systems that are targeted more towards population health. So I kind of like this slide here because it's incredibly timely because I can curry favor with the two people who just walked in, but I'll get to that at the end of the slide. So in many facilities, there is some combination of an electronic, in many facilities in sub-Saharan Africa, in Vietnam, in Haiti, in many facilities, there's some combination of an electronic medical record, a laboratory information system, an LIS, and a pharmacy system. I was talking with Neil Abernathy briefly, and he told me to be sure to point out that a lot of the work we do is with open source information systems of various types. So EMRs, Open MRS, is a very commonly implemented at different kinds of levels of function system across Africa. eSante is a system that we've implemented in Haiti in about 70 sites, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. ICAP and IQ Care are NGO-driven systems that have been implemented in Kenya, and actually they've been implemented in a number of countries, but we interact with them mostly in Kenya. Lab information systems, we do a lot of development around OpenELIS, and my examples for this talk come from OpenELIS, but there's a Meditech's a big commercial vendor who's had some inroads into Africa, and Beka Labs. Beka Labs is a small open source system from South Africa that has mainly implementations in South Africa, but we interact with them a little bit as well. Pharmacy systems, without meaning to name those, let me kind of skip to some of the population systems and talk about the pharmacy systems. I want to mention that Management Sciences for Health is a big consulting firm that works for USAID, and they have a dispensing system called the Electronic Dispensing Tool, EDT, which is an access-based system, which will also come up in the examples. All of those systems feed information into systems that are at the regional or national level for program monitoring and evaluation. That's the M&E buzzword for surveillance and for logistics management information. And that the part that when I blanked out the screen right before I started the talk, that was to quickly add the name Village Reach under LMIS, and the two people who just walked in are from Village Reach, which is a Seattle-based NGO. So maybe we'll have time to talk more about that during the questions. I put this slide up because, of course, what I described before were silos of information. No good way to connect information at the facility level between a lab system which CDC might put in, an EMR which USAID might pay for in an effort to get better reporting data. And often there's not a good way to interconnect those systems. But what you'd really like to sort of remove those silos of information is this ideal, N-way connectivity, which is very expensive in terms of interface design, very expensive in terms of implementation, but very useful in terms of having a good way to be able to look at all the information about a patient in a facility, to be able to make sure that information from lab surveillance and electronic medical records are both combined in the national surveillance system.
Yes. The value of this is obvious. I guess what I'm wondering is when you show those pictures of like buildings that were literally falling down around them or a lab that
didn't have a lot of stuff.
I see that value. I guess I'm trying to understand where things like EMRs and like electronic health records kind of stack rank with what these people in that context versus
drugs.
People at
right.
Job, and I'm just trying to...
Yeah, so far and away, most of the money that goes into HIV care goes into medications, purchasing medications, distributing medications. That's what the sort of whole, that's part of what the whole logistics management information systems world is about. There's also other things which need to be distributed to provide care, lab supplies, vaccines, even just regular routine clinical supplies, a wide variety of stuff. So trying to balance the need for getting stuff out to where it can be swallowed by people or injected in people, and with the need to understand whether you're having any kind of impact on the epidemic, it is kind of, that's the tension, right? So people on the monitoring and evaluation side are sort of desperate for data. People on the clinical care side want to make sure that the cry for data doesn't result in them getting decreased resources to run the clinic. So I don't know if it helps to tell you that, like, that's an important thing.
I'm just sort of wondering, like, it's a very clean kind of UW-Seattle context, just sort of
right.
Wondering how people stack right now.
Yeah, you know, so even in that lab where there's just sort of a, you know, random collection of bottles and no automated analyzer, there's still a desire to be able to get the result of looking through the microscope and looking at a smear. There's still the desire to get that result to several places at once. And that winds up being done better electronically, better with computerized systems than it is with manual systems. Skype from Partners in Health, who sort of has the Paul Farmer's NGO, who sort of has a similar job to what I have with iTech. And he's got some data that he published a couple of years ago on the number of repeat CD4s ordered because a CD4 wasn't available 30 days after. It wasn't available to the patient's return visit to start treatment. And it was something like 30%, and they reduced it. I mean, it was only 68% or only 50% of the CD4s were available, and they managed to reduce that by a significant fraction by just having a sort of simple computerized system to record and retain those lab results. So, I mean, that happens to be a lab example, and PIH's focus isn't on labs. But I really think it is the same problems we have here and the same... I'm sure you guys have heard, I'm sure, lots of discussion about medical errors and the role of information systems and interacting with those and duplicated services and so forth. So the same thing happens at a different level and with a different type of service provision. But I think everywhere people aren't so good at failing at retaining information. Computers are better.
Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, no problem. Anyway, my point of this slide was just I want to concentrate on the EMR lab stuff. So I want to shift gears a little bit and go back and talk about some three basic premises of our work. One is that interoperability is a good thing. Interoperability is such a good thing that it can be best represented with a slice of apple pie. Standards aren't sufficient, and so why not? You know, why don't we just use standards? HL7 is a great standard, and I found this thing on a forum a couple of years ago about HL7 communication with PACS systems, and the gist of this long conversation is, how come it's not working? I'm getting errors. Well, I'm using this standard. I'm using 2.3.1. Well, it turns out that the system that you're trying to communicate with really uses 2.3, it's just endless little rat holes that you can disappear down trying to implement standards-based interoperability. I guess the fourth premise is, so standards aren't sufficient. The third premise is that e-health architecture is good. And along with that, this is a block diagram of the Canada Health Infoway. And I just put it up there because this is the kind of stuff that gets drawn out by committees. And implementing this in that kind of intermittent power marginal clinic in Haiti is pretty difficult, but this is what a good committee agrees needs to be done. So corollary to the e-health architectures is good is that block diagrams are good. And I think that the purpose that block diagrams are actually serve, the reason that block diagrams really are good, is to look for conserved information exchanges, to look for design patterns within those block diagrams. And as you can probably figure, this is where I'm going to turn to Wikipedia, which is a great source for a good definition of design patterns. And in particular, the part that I really care about is that design patterns are a general reusable solution to a commonly occurring problem within a given context in software design, and in particular, the kind of design patterns that we look for are these structural design patterns within interoperability. So how do we shape the structure of an information interaction in a way that's repeatable? To implement an architecture, you have to have a good functional description of the components in that architecture. You don't want to have a lot of ambiguity about where a lab result goes. Sometimes it might get entered into EMR. Sometimes it might get sent into a lab system and transferred to the EMR. That's not a good kind of ambiguity to have. You want to be able to describe the business processes that cause that data to flow and pretty carefully in well-circumscribed use cases. You want to know who touches the information and under what conditions it moves. We use a framework that came out of a U.S. interoperability initiative called Integrating the Healthcare Enterprise, and that framework defines interoperability profiles, and I think I might have, an interoperability profile is a structured description of content, format, and method of an information exchange and of the business rules governing that exchange. I made this definition up, so this is just the pseudo-academic part where I get to cite myself. But what it really comes from is IHE, and so this is just here so you can go look at the slides eventually and steal the URL. IHE.net is kind of an interesting group because it's a vendor-driven consortium that's really looked to take kind of all of the ways that people connect healthcare information system and try and put them in a common framework that's flexible enough to include what everybody's doing. That also doesn't work really well for resource poor settings because we need to start winnowing away some of that everything possible and take IHE's very large interoperability profiles and kind of focus them down on stuff that is much better defined and involves much less reading. Or was that not being recorded? Well, so this will be half a podcast. So, the interoperability framework that we use comes from IHE. I'm glad the part about critique of IHE wasn't recorded, but I can tell you that our sort of resource-constrained interoperability profiles contain fewer participants, fewer use cases. We implement them using a simpler set of transactions, and we constrain the standards much more carefully. So it isn't just about using HL7 2.5.1 for lab results. It's about using a specific transaction that comes from the, in our case, something called the eLinks implementation guide for HL7 2.5.1 results. And that lets us kind of point somebody to a much narrower slice of documentation and say, this is how the message actually is. This is what the HL7 message is supposed to look. This is when you're supposed to send it. This is how these are the rules that a system has to follow to consume it. And so I kind of want to jump into a section and talking about some of these specific examples. And I think that the main thing I want to point out from this slide is that where I'm going with all this is the design pattern that we developed for EMR lab connections turns out, part of that design pattern turns out to be very useful for EMR pharmacy connections. So a couple of years ago, we were able to put EMR lab and EMR pharmacy demographics, information, exchange of information about patients in place. And I'll talk about that fingerprint stuff as well. So just a recap of the simplification of an IHE profile to come up with a lab profile. What does that use case actually looks like? Well, the simple use case that we're trying to tackle, which is pretty common in health centers that have a single, health centers with a small attached lab, is that the staff collects and receives a specimen. That in the lab, the staff collects and receives a specimen, the results are produced, the results are sent to clinic, and the results are received in the clinic. And that's really the piece that we've focused on, is that little loop in red. The stuff in blue that happens is kind of the manual stuff that goes along with that. So we're very happy to have clinic staff placing orders. We're very happy to have that continue to be implemented manually for the time being. That actually works pretty well. It's rare that you can give a lab slip to a patient, they can walk across the compound to the lab, and you don't really need the electronic order to arrive there before the patient does. The patient can usually identify themselves. Let me not get too off track on that. But simplification, you got to look for places to simplify. So order transmission on paper, this is sort of our three phases working on the lab profile. The first thing that we kind of developed was a profile of order transmission on paper and identification of matching the patient in the lab with the EMR. The second thing that we worked on is once the patient is identified in the EMR, you want to be able to send a result back. In our system, at UW, I'm not sure that the patient has that the lab system has to know that the patient is identified in the EMR. I have a feeling the lab system can probably send a result, and then there's some erroring condition on the EMR side that indicates that a result wasn't properly matched. We don't want, there's no workflow, there's no process for doing that in those kind of settings that we work in. There's no people who are available to do that. So we decided early on, we build a system to require as a constraint, as a simplifying constraint, that you could only send results for a patient that you knew was already in the EMR, which meant that we had to know first that the demographics matched. Finally, there's this is where we'd include identification transmitted order, but this is really the one that we've concentrated on as our basic pattern. An order going on paper, demographic query and result going from the lab to the EMR and back, and then a test result going back. There'll be a lot of green boxes coming up, and my goal is to, my goal is to show how that pattern works in a couple different places. As far as identification of patient in the EMR, we have a specific HL7-based transaction set that we use for that. As far as result transmission, as I mentioned, we use the IHE, we use a specific Lab 3 transaction that specifies specific messages. We use a specific interaction from IHE, and then we use this E-Links implementation guide for the semantic constraints. And again, you know, this is all stuff that in between our systems at UW, all of this stuff would be sort of negotiated as one goes along. There isn't universal agreement in the states about any of this, about using E-Links, about using this particular profile, that sort of thing. Four examples of where we've done that. One is to connect the lab system to the EMR in Haiti. Another is to connect the lab system to OpenMRS, the EMR that Partners in Health uses in Rwanda, Lesotho, and Haiti, and that UCSF uses in UCSF and Reagan Street use in Kenya. So those are sort of the strategic partners for us on that. The third example is the extension of this demographic query to support a facility patient index, a standalone facility patient index, a standalone way of managing identity at a facility. And I think that the reason for that will be a little more obvious from a couple of the diagrams. But that turns out to be, the reason for that is actually interesting, that notion of identity management and identity verification, you could think of how you use that in registering a patient, right? The patient comes in and you want to know, have they ever been seen before? If not, you want to create an entry for them. Patient comes in and you want to know, who are they? Are they who they, what's their first name, what's their last name? And from that, you want to look up their medical record. I don't mean taking a DNA sample and confirming that they're who they are, but I just mean, verifying who the patient is, what do we know about them. So that notion of identity and management and identity verification, those transactions are really easy to understand in a clinical setting. But it turns out there's a lot of other people working on similar kinds of population management problems. So WHO and Health Metrics Network have put a lot of attention towards vital signs registries. And the same kinds of things, what you want to do to build a vital sign registry is you want to be able to manage the identity of a large number of people, and you want to be able to confirm to verify their identity at different service points. There was an article in the paper this morning about Chris Elias, the guy who leads PATH, who's going to go over to Gates Foundation. The informatics lead at PATH is a guy named David Levinsky, who I think has talked here on some occasions, or should if he hasn't, anyway. And Levinsky is an interesting guy who works with WHO on, among other things, actually does lots of interesting things, but one of the things he's worked on is national insurance schemes. And what do you need to do for national insurance schemes? It's that same design pattern of enrolling people and managing their identity and then verifying transactions around that identity. So anyway, I said I wasn't going to talk about number three. I actually think number three is one of the more interesting design patterns going on. And then finally, for a demonstration at NetInfo a couple of years ago, we connected our lab system to that Canada Health Info Way, which is kind of an HL7 version 3 XML-based interoperability framework. So in order to apply it, in Haiti, I mentioned that Partners in Health uses OpenMRS. We have our lab system implemented, and actually this is in 2010, 10 sites. Now it's implemented in about 20 sites. As is true with many things in the developing world, it doesn't run particularly well at all 20 sites, but we have a small, solid handful of users of sites using it at this point. We have about 70 sites for HIV care and treatment that use our electronic medical record, and about, you know, I shouldn't just read from the slide, but about 71,000 patients under care and treatment. So it's a pretty good-sized population for a distributed networked EMR, which manages to pull information from all those 71 sites, about 35 servers to serve those 70 sites, and build a national composite server to be used for that's used for reporting purposes. So that's kind of the general framework of our electronic medical record and lab system. To do that connection, the specifics of how we've implemented it are we've used HTTP posts to support that query and response demographics interface. The format of this was done a while back, and the data elements are standardized, but they don't fit into a standardized message. The result is the lab result is sent as an ORU RO1. That's that specific type of HL7 message that goes along with the eLinks framework. So that's how we implemented it. And I guess the important part is that even though some of the individual transactions are different, the framework, the handshake, the flow of information is the exact same as. Sorry about that. It is the exact same as what we've done with OpenMRS. We've built a module within their EMR. We've used a slightly different set of transactions, but we were able to get this work done much more quickly. And by a single student in India working on a Google Summer of Code project this summer, we were able to get this work done much more quickly because we didn't have to start from scratch. We already had this nice design pattern and basically said, how are we going to follow that with OpenMRS? The red box is just that we built a module in OpenMRS to make that work more smoothly with OpenMRS's architecture. I wanted to talk about extending that concept, extending that design pattern. So the lowest hanging fruit for us to move forward in 2009 in Haiti was to look at the way the thing we had built with the lab system was demographics, and we were trying to decide whether to do results next or something else. And one of the things that we came across was that the pharmacy folks in Haiti are part of this national supply chain management system project, and they were desperate to get the demographic information out of the EMR. They actually wanted to keep it for reasons of their own. They didn't really want to share back a lot of dispensing information with us because they wanted the pharmacy system to have that information. But the important part was there was a door open there to start information exchange. So we used that same design pattern, those same queries, and the MSH people built that demographic query into the pharmacy system. And so now, for the first time in Haiti, we had a single system being used as a source demographic system by the pharmacy system and by the lab system. It happens that the electronic medical record was where that data lived, and I'm not sure that's the right place for it, but at least it was a good start. So we had something before the earthquake in Haiti. We had something that kind of looked like this, where paper orders were going both to lab and pharmacy. There was an electronic, there's a computerized exchange that looked identical between pharmacy for demographic information between lab and pharmacy, and we had the results well specified but not built. Similar concept works very well with OpenMRS. What's missing from that is the way this is drawn, you know, what's missing from that is the fact that the pharmacy system arrows actually plug into that same red slot, and that's where it starts to be useful. September, we have results working, just the solid arrow from the lab system to the EMR. We had some scope creep. There's always scope creep. And turned out that CDC is really keen on this idea of being able to unambiguously identify patients beyond sort of the identity verification stuff. They really wanted to use biometrics as part of identity verification in Haiti for HIV patients. And so we were asked to build a fingerprint component, an EMP component, fingerprint component, and hang it on the bottom of the EMR. And so, again, you can kind of see where I'm going with this is that fingerprinting and smart cards and other kinds of biometric devices need a place in the system. And they've been used in many different countries for slightly different purposes, and almost always they're pretty tightly coupled with a single system. And that's not a great way to do it because you have these very general functions of identity management and identity verification. And so the goal would really be to look at what are the patterns with which all of those systems need to interact around identity and to develop a facility-level patient index for identity transactions. There's a couple of different ways to do that. I think that I'm not going to take the time to go into too much of it other than to draw this sort of more idealized architecture where that open MRS, let's say we used open MRS for a facility level index. Well, we've already written a module that can let open MRS behave as an identity server. So we could take a version of open MRS, a version of that electronic medical record, strip out all the electronic medical record stuff, and just use it for identity management. We've written, unfortunately, the fingerprint stuff we've written doesn't really hang on OpenMRS. It happens to hang on eSante, but it's, you know, software implementation detail to be left to the user, particularly if anybody's looking for a good project. So more on patient identity management. I jumped ahead and told you about this earlier. So it turns out the design patterns there at the bottom, patient index, national health insurance, vital registration, I think those are sort of the drivers for us to really kind of focus on that area. And I guess where I want to wind up is to say, so this is the architecture that we're trying to work towards, a set of reusable patterns that allow us to quickly build interfaces between these well-defined components to reuse the business rules as much as possible. That example of, I can't send you a result unless I know that you already know about the patient, that's a hugely simplifying business rule. It means you don't have to have a process for erroring out information. It means that the lab is responsible, for instance, if the lab can't deliver a result through the computerized system, the lab has to come up with a way. Well, they already have a way. They already print out the results and send them to the clinic. So there already is a mechanism for taking results and folding them up into a paper airplane and hoping they reach their target. So we won't make that problem any worse. It's just that we can make it better in the instances where we do know that there's a connection. And then standards-based interoperability is the other component of that architecture. So where that leaves us is kind of jumping down to describing things as good. We've presented this architecture in a number of different venues now, and each time we get to color in more of the boxes. And evaluating things as good. Evaluating things is what would make it go from, you know, software engineering to academics, to science, exactly. And so some of the questions that we've been kind of wrestling with is, how do we measure utility? Like, we can get a rough handle on what's the utility of an electronic medical record in Haiti. We can look at how the indicators for service delivery change over time. We can compare those indicators to the cost. I'm making it sound easy, like nobody has good data on this stuff, but at least I can understand what that method would be. But how do we talk about measuring the utility of a design pattern? Or the utility of interoperability? You know, does it save time? Does it save money? We don't typically measure those implementation costs. Like every other NGO out there, we scramble for enough money to do our work. So we can look at data quality. Does having these interfaces in place improve accuracy, completeness, and timeliness of the data? And that's something that we've used as an evaluation strategy for our work in public health surveillance and influenza surveillance primarily. Anyway, you know, just in understanding the information exchange, it's nice to think of what would the indicators for adoption be. All of the adoption of all of these open source systems, by and large, is driven by personal relationships between the people who work on them. That's not really a very durable measure. But so I think that, you know, if we got an N of 1, if we got a stranger to adopt our design pattern, that would be an awesome mark of success. Anyway, I didn't promise that I'd wind up with, like, a great conclusion and kind of a nice thing you guys could take out of here and say, that's how it's done. So the best I can do is wind up with a question mark. And 11 minutes. So I'd be happy to take any questions about this stuff, about the work we do, about why Libby and Alan decided to come to the talk, that sort of stuff.
So the question when you deal with centralized things like patient servers, or this idea of needing to talk about a single instance of, or how do you deal with that when power goes up and down? Like, do you park your server someplace? Like,
it's
all hopped out of somewhere. Right?
So PIH used to run all of their information systems in Haiti out of Boston. And that's not popular for a variety of reasons. One reason it's not that popular is people have this concept of sovereignty of data, right? So countries want the data. It's kind of a meaningless concept in the age of fast networking, but countries want the data to reside in the country. The other thing is that one of the ways to make infrastructure more reliable is to distribute it and then to try and make the individual components more reliable. So what we've done, I shouldn't have started with an example of PIH, but their example is good for one other reason also, and that is just to mention that since all of their connections were by satellite connections, you get this guaranteed latency of 0.3 seconds to the satellite, 0.3 seconds up and down, and 0.3 seconds for the response up and down. So it's, you add 0.6 seconds to every human transaction. And that problem is actually made worse when you get sort of data sovereignty and people insist on putting the satellite in the country, because the Earth station for the satellite that we all use in Haiti is in Georgia, I think. And so it actually is much better to have the server in Georgia rather than to have another loop to get back from Georgia back to the satellite and then back to Georgia and then back to the user. So it actually is like 1.2 seconds latency. So those satellite terminals are not a great idea. They're also expensive and so forth. We still use them in Haiti quite a bit because in order to get better performance, what we've done and what Partners in Health has also done with OpenMRS is to both move the servers out into the clinical sites wherever that can be done, and it really requires a pretty minimal amount of infrastructure to do that, and to make opportunistic. Partners does full synchronization between all their servers because they're all part of the same care network. We actually do sort of selective replication because Catholic Relief Services in Haiti doesn't really feel like it's appropriate for, some other network of providers to be able to look at all of their identified HIV data and so forth. So we try and make systems that are pretty robust, that stand on their own, and that are able to opportunistically share data whenever they sense that an internet connection has popped open. And they work pretty hard at trying to pop those connections open. You can imagine we're often behind several layers of NAT routers, so we've also done some stuff more recently that's just clever engineering based on kind of opening connections and having sort of opening outward connections and then having backward propagated connections come through when they see a forward connection is open. A lot of the clinics will have kind of a bank of 12-volt batteries, a connection to the local grid, reliable or not, and then a set of inverters. And those batteries are used to power the critical stuff. And the critical stuff is typically some amount of lighting and the lab equipment and increasingly some small number of computers. And so we fit into that small number of computers. In Haiti, the infrastructure implementation strategy that CDC pushed early on was to put, real servers, things that were wider than they were tall and that had dual power supplies and, to put real hardware out there because that was the American way. That was the better way to do it. And we're really trying to push pretty hard to get people to, we try and build most of this stuff as lightweight virtual appliances now, and we try and push pretty hard to get people to use laptops because they have their own built-in power protection. We use Mac Minis as servers now because they're, 4 gigabyte, 4-core, 500 gigabyte hard drive boxes that don't require a whole lot of power to operate. So if there's a specific area, I could tell you more about it. But I think in general, it's easier to build robust systems. Physical security is always a problem.
So your focus of your talk is on the patterns of the infrastructure, and that's great. But the topic was identity management, and you didn't really talk about whether that was hard or not. And there was great talk at AMIA.
No, the topic was design patterns for physical architectures. Okay, but I brought up identity
but
management.
The message is actually being passed and forth about
Identity management is an interesting component.
Right. So there's a great talk at AMIA that pointed out that the VA in the United States has 2,000 John R. Smiths born on the same day in the same year.
Yeah.
So how does that kind of problem pan out at these resource poor countries that have very different naming schemes and addresses?
Right. And in Haiti, a lot of what we see as French first names are used in Haiti as both first and last names. The Haiti identifier, there is a national identifier in Haiti, which is not unique. And it was, let's see if I can remember what it was. It's like the first two letters of the patient's name and the patient's, first two letters of the patient's mother's name and some portion of the birthday. It's like a 10-character string. And when we first saw that, we were told by the CDC and the Ministry of Health that was the Haitian national identifier and that everything had to be keyed to that. So we, of course, said, hey, looks like an attribute to us, and carefully constructed a UUID a unique identifier as the underlying, that's the underlying identifier in our systems. And it can match to all sorts of externally visible things, and so we're happy to have somebody report a patient's national identifier. It turns out that the sequence in which they came in for ARV treatment, the sequential treatment number is actually a better identifier, but even that's not guaranteed to be unique. We keep a kind of constellation of demographic information and ask that the registration process identify the patient. So the patient's village, the patient's mother's name, the patient's rough date of birth if they were known.
Back and forth that just shows 2 hours, might be more than 2 hours. Or do you do everything?
So when you look up a patient from the, if you're the lab registration person, right, I guess, the other principle I didn't really talk about is it's important that the systems be able to stand alone because they're not that reliable. And if the lab system, if the database gets corrupted, something that doesn't impact hardware at all, but if the database gets corrupted, you don't want the clinical system not to work, right, or vice versa. So the workflow that's part of that, the details of that design pattern is that for laboratory registration, for instance, is that you look up a patient, and what you get back are the matches from the lab system. You get the matches from the authoritative source, the patient index or the EMR, and then you can select which one you want. And if once you have said that's the patient from the master patient index, and it's the same as this lab patient, then the medical record for that patient gets bound. And then that's what allows us to say, yeah, the central system knows about it, so we can send a result.
Does a human make the decision?
A human always makes the decision. Yeah, there's no... This is in clinical care, you don't really want the probabilistic matching to say, 85% chance it was the correct CD4, so we'll go ahead and treat the patient. But yeah, so this, so there's always a part in the process where, the patient's walking up to a desk and saying, here I am for my appointment. And that narrows the field of 2,048 John Smiths substantially, because really only one of them knows that they had an appointment that day. But it is important to unambiguously know when that person comes back. So, Eric.
Kind of reminds me of a quote from a couple of Australian software developers, which was applying computerized automation to a broken or ill-defined process simply results in a broken computerized process.
Right.
And I wonder if you could just talk for a little bit about the difference between going in and saying, there is a well-defined paper process that we can enhance with a computerized system versus there is no process I want to build you one with a computer. Because I would suspect that the outcomes would be different.
Right. We are almost always working in a situation where there is a process in place. And there's variance from that process to, there's some variance from one clinic to the next. But typically the ministries of health and the donors have worked hard to stamp out that variance by saying, you can't just record the lab values in a book. Here is the National Lab Registry. So there's a set of data elements. Now, there can be problems in how those data elements are understood, right? So there is still some smoothing out of variance that we do in implementing a computerized system. I want to kind of also sort of shift gears and talk about that from kind of a very different tack. I think that oftentimes the processes are not so bad as we in the computer field think they are. So I worked on a project in bioengineering probably 8 years ago that was funded by the Singapore government. A component of that project that I was responsible for was looking at personal health records and their use up in Everett, in a underserved clinic up in Everett. And so there was a point at which we had a couple of information science students from Singapore who came for a quarter and were kind of working on this project here. And the thing that they couldn't believe about personal health records is that we would allow patients to enter their own information. Because, like, the process doesn't have anything to do with patients entering their own information. The process has to do with clinicians saying what's true about the patient, not with patients making up stuff and not understanding stuff and that kind of thing. And I could never get them to see that, like, that's how the clinician knows, is that you talk to the patient in the first place. You ask the patient. You wouldn't accept what somebody wrote in their personal health record uncritically any more than you would sort of fail to listen critically when somebody was giving you their history. I don't mean criticizing. I mean fail to listen with an ear towards, you know, what's this guy saying? What does this sound like? What are the clinical patterns involved in the story that the patient's telling me? So I kind of think, you know, a lot of things in medicine, that process of taking a history can be improved on. The patient can write parts of the history on their own. It can be structured so it's quicker for the clinician to read it. It can be structured so it can be used for clinical decision support. But it's tempting for us to say the whole process is broken, and I'm not so sure it is. I don't think the process of clinical care in Haiti is desperately broken. I think it's incredibly resource constrained. I don't think the process in Kenya is broken. I don't think that having national identifier is anywhere near as important as the people who push for national identifiers think it is. I think that knowing that an instance of a patient is the same as the instance of the patient who had his blood drawn 30 days ago, I think that's critically important. So we have to be able to do the underlying thing, which maybe the registration clerk does because there's only 800 people in the service area of that clinic, and of course they know who they are. You know, so I hope I can just duck out of the question by saying, maybe it's not so broken as people say, but it is pretty important to look not first at the information system you want to build, but to look first at the information exchanges that happen in that system and decide where the problems are. And almost always broken, I think, is that information gets lost, that it gets that it isn't available to be duplicated the way we'd like it to be, and so forth.
It's kind of hard to reproduce with a computer that registration person ability to say, oh, Bob,
exactly.
Hey, welcome back.
So the bottom line to me is it would be a big mistake to try and do that. But there's ton of work in probabilistic matching, and for population health, it starts to make more sense. So, okay, well, now we're a minute and a half over. So I'm happy to stick around for a bit if there's other specific questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.